From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Bill T. Jones, one of today's most innovative choreographers, was an athlete before he was a dancer. On today's Fresh Air, from the stadium to the stage. Also today, we talked to Deirdre Murray. She's one of the few women instrumentalists in jazz and one of the even fewer jazz cellists. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews tenor saxophonist Ralph Moore's new album. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about commercials that disguise themselves as programs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev today called on Arab leaders to take a more active role in finding a peaceful solution to the Persian Gulf crisis, saying it was time to introduce what he called the Arab factor. His remarks came at a news conference in Paris following talks with President Mitterrand. Stephen Jessel of the BBC has this report.
Saudi Arabia, he said, might take the lead in the calling of such a conference, and he thought that the Iraqi government would be ready to accept the idea. Mr. Gorbachev showed rather more optimism about the outcome of the visit to Baghdad by the Soviet emissary, Mr. Yevgeny Primakov, than Mr. Primakov himself had displayed at the end of it. A telegram he had received at 5 o'clock that morning had indicated, he said, that Saddam Hussein's position was not what it had been some time previously. There had been the appearance of some fresh thinking. Mr. Gorbachev said that any military option was unacceptable, though it wasn't clear from Mr. Gorbachev's remarks to whom it was unacceptable. But he warned Saddam Hussein not to gamble in that respect, and he denounced the conduct of Iraq and what he described as its adventurist policy.
Stephen Jessel in Paris. Election officials in the Soviet Republic of Georgia said today that a pro-independence group has won a landslide victory over the communist government. The republic's first free election in 70 years apparently resulted in a 2-1 victory for the opposition group Roundtable Free Georgia. The preliminary results show the group with 60% of the vote. A final count is expected to be complete in several days. Roundtable has pledged to seek independence from the Central Soviet government, although its officials have refused to set a timetable. The Israeli government says it will keep many Palestinians from entering Israel, despite a decision to lift the order sealing off the occupied territories. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from Jerusalem.
Under the new restrictions announced this evening and taking effect immediately, any Palestinian convicted of hostile activity against Israel is barred from entering the country from the territories. The order also applies to those who have been held under administrative detention without having formal charges filed against them. The order could affect some 20,000 Palestinians. The government says barred Arabs who refrain from hostile acts can reapply for permission to enter Israel after an unspecified period of time. The government today also banned the Islamic Jihad organization, accusing it of terrorist acts, and said Palestinian leader Faisal Husseini is barred from leaving Israel. Husseini was released from jail last week after being held since the killings on the Temple Mount Haram Sharif, October 8th. This is Brian Naylor in Jerusalem.
A sharp rise in oil prices pushed stock prices down on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 6 points to close at 2,430.2. Declines led advances by 2-1 in light trading. Volume was 134 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane and Company remains the name of the dance troupe, though Arnie Zane died of AIDS 2 years ago. But his influence and absence are still strongly felt in the company's new dances. My guest, Bill T. Jones, began performing with Zane in the early 70s. By the mid-80s, they had become among the most successful dance companies in New York City. They were featured on the PBS Great Performances series, toured through Asia, and won a BESSIE, the New York Dance and Performance Award, for Best Choreography. Jones and Zane were known for their collaborations with innovative visual artists such as painter Keith Haring, clothes designer Willie Smith, and artist Jenny Holzer. Since Zane's death, Bill T. Jones has continued to dance and choreograph. He will premiere a new work next week. Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Promised Land, is set to original music by Julius Hempel and is part of the Next Wave series at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I spoke with Bill T. Jones in February, and he told me how he developed a dance he was performing at the time, D-Man in the Waters.
It was inspired by a company member, Damien Acquavella, who was very ill with AIDS. And at the time that I was making the piece, in the late fall of 87 and in the January of 88, he was going through all sorts of procedures and regimes and trying many different things to, you know, regain his health. The idea of water was very strong in my mind. And then I had this image one day of people out swimming in the water in very rough waters, and some of them not making it, some of them making it. You know, ultimately it's about struggle in general. I'm very, very involved in the struggle with AIDS right now, but I don't want any of the work to get totally pigeonholed as being AIDS work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is about struggle in general.
Would you describe, if you could, some of the choreography in that piece?
Well, let's see. If you can imagine, if you will, people throwing themselves into the floor with the same freedom and commitment that a person throws himself into a swimming pool, people supporting each other as if you were doing first aid, life-saving maneuvers with one another, people leaping and diving in such a way as to suggest dolphins and birds, a huge man, gigantic, kind of unpredictable presence on stage, standing like a monolithic totem with four lithe and women dancers with their legs draped around his neck as he stares into the heavens. And there's a moment where you want to laugh, but then you realize there's something quite arresting about it. Two other men rush on and dive, throw themselves in the air, and are caught instantaneously by two of those four women who were standing there. Constant shifting of patterns, people diving in from the wings, jumping off from the wings, music that moves as if it were a movie score for an old Western, but beautifully made. I say that if Mendelssohn was alive now, and he wrote this when he was 16, he'd probably be working with electric guitars and bass. It's a very moving work.
And the people make very convincing waves, too. kind of ebbing
so.
And flowing. I think that works really well.
Well, you know, that's a very kind of dangerous image because, you know, there's been a lot of corny work done about water, and there's been some great work done about water. This is coming from a place which is extremely athletic, and as a result, I think it has vitality.
It's been, I think, less than a year since your late partner Arnie Zane died.
No, it's actually more now.
It's more than
a year?
He
died in March of 1988.
Oh.
Right. So it's now, we're now approaching 2 years.
Oh. So much of your work has been involved with him over the years that I'd like to ask you a few questions about your long-term collaboration with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that he was 25 when he started to dance, and that was at your suggestion?
Yeah, 24 or 25. Yeah, it's true. He was just by nature a very creative and artistic person. And when I met him, he was just returning back from living in Amsterdam, and he was just beginning to do photography. And, of course, I was one of his prime models. We were living in Brockport, New York, and I was trying to get my degree in dance at the State University College there. And I invited him to come out and try this thing called contact improvisation. A little leaflet had been given to me that says, if you like to do the Lindy, if you like to do karate or jujitsu or anything like that, come on out and join us. And I said to him, come try it. And, well, he was open to it. He went. Before that, he had moaned every morning when I would try to get him to do yoga, you know, just lay on the floor and put his feet over his head and touch the floor. He hated it. He thought I was a cruel taskmaster. But I said, you know, all the things of the, you know, the health culture, it would extend his life and so on and so forth. And in most things, we fought it out, but we found some sort of compromise.
Well, you did a lot of duets together. You choreographed a lot.
A lot, yes.
For him, since he lacked the kind of technical virtuosity that a dancer who got a start a lot younger would have, mm-hmm. how did you use that in the choreography?
Well, you have to realize that we were products of a time that was questioning all sorts of rules about dance making. If you know anything about the Judson Church movement, of which people like David Gordon and Patricia Brown and Yvonne Rainer were leaders, one of their whole ideas was to rethink the need for technical display, what was wrong with pedestrian movement and the pedestrian limits, if you will, that these movements would bring to choreography. So we were very much influenced by those ideas, and Contact gave us the freedom to understand that there were ways of really moving freely and eloquently that didn't demand pointed feet and turned out hip sockets. So we didn't feel at all fettered by that. There were whole other areas that had to be explored. We looked to the East, we looked to Tai Chi, we looked to karate, jiu-jitsu for ways of doing a virtuosic but naturalistic virtuosity.
So many people have commented over the years on how you were opposites when you danced. You're tall, he was short. You're black, he was white. Did you use that in the choreography?
Well, I think it was... Yeah, I was going to say it used us, but I'm not sure that's too glib. We didn't know. I mean, not that, we weren't total innocents, but like I say in our book, Body Against Body, the new one that's just come out now, there is something... We woke up one morning in Germany, and we were going to be doing our Blauwelt Mountain piece there. We had never thought that this piece, which took a cinder block wall apart upstage and built it through the center of the stage, we hadn't thought at all about East and West Germany. But suddenly we were in Berlin, and that context threw the work into a whole different light. And we were very excited by that, and the Germans were also very excited. They gave us a German Critics Award. Likewise with our physicality. We were friends before we were collaborators. We enjoyed each other's bodies before we were dance partners. So were we self-conscious about it? I think we later began to know there was power in it. But in the beginning, we didn't. And that's when it was most exciting, actually.
How long after Arnie Zane was diagnosed with AIDS was he able to dance? And did he want to dance?
Well, you have to realize that early on, Arnie used to joke. He said, those people who say to live is to dance, they're crazy. He did not feel that way about dancing. He danced. It had an interest for him at a certain point. And he considered himself always a person who would be creative no matter what he did. So he was becoming more interested in being a director anyways. So I'd say, our last major duet was probably 1983. We did do, duet was part of our work that we did in Intuitive Momentum with Max Roach at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in about 1980, late 83, early 84. The last time he was on stage, of course, I remember exactly, was in Cleveland in January 10th of 1988, which is pretty amazing considering he died March 30th of 1988.
Did you throw yourself back into dance after his death?
And throw is a very good word, too. Yes, I threw myself right back into the studio. I was very fortunate that we had already agreed to do these City Center performances on May 6th. He died on March 30th, as I said. Our rehearsals were scheduled to start again on April 4th, and we had plenty of time to feel the sadness, but we also had a job to do, and it seemed that it was the right thing to do. So yes, and I made immediately two or three new works and helped get a bunch of his works to stage, and I've been moving that way ever since then.
Now, you were an athlete before you were a dancer.
Yes, I was. I was a runner, and I was a sprinter, as a matter of fact. I was pretty good. My best time was about a 9.9 for the 100. And these days, I think high school guys do probably 9.5, 9.6. But for that time, it was pretty good.
How did you get from athlete to dancer, or from running to dancing?
I still feel
like an athlete.
Feel like an athlete, and I'm sure my dancers would say the way in which I train them and rehearse them, I behave like a coach. That's for sure. I love sweat. When I was in the State University in 1970, there was this sort of holy lineage I'd been handed personally from my high school coach to the college coach, and they, you know, there was this real warmth I felt from my coaches, and I would do anything for them except. When I got to college, I began to become, things were changing. I mean, there was always the protest of the period. There was the drug culture. There was this thing called dance that reared its head that pulled me away from track practice. And I had a really understanding coach in college who said, okay, well, if you're in these West African dance classes, then you are working on your stretch and your cardiovascular, so it's good. You don't have to come to practice. Well, little did he know that I was being more and more seduced away from athletics and the macho locker room scene by that very daily practice of going to dance classes. There was also Arnie. He and I, the things that were that my discovery of my sexuality and all this stuff made it more and more difficult for me to be a part of the good old boy system of the gymnasium and the locker rooms. And so a lot of things were happening. And dance won out because, as I often say, there was something so incredibly right about a young athlete becoming a dancer. The abstract beauty of dance appealed to me, appealed to my body and that poetic side of my nature.
What did you find alienating about the macho locker room culture?
Well, it was not emotionally articulate enough. It was that I needed more passion, more closeness. I needed a way of understanding the myriad of things that I was experiencing internally and externally in a way that sports could not deliver, and that system of man at a distance, man fighting man, just couldn't deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, I've now tried to go back and understand what it means to be a man and what it means to love that aspect of men, but keeping the sensitivity and the things I have learned elsewhere, and dance has been one of those places. Dance is a world which is peculiar because it's really dominated in a way by women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. It was very important for me to understand that the strength and the softness of women and the articulation and emotionally that women can have.
Did you come out when you started to dance? Publicly?
Well, come out. Yeah, I guess you might say. I guess in a way it was. It was Arnie and I were friends, and I was on the track team. But shortly after we became lovers, I stopped doing sports and left school altogether. So dance was part of leaving school. I went to Amsterdam to try to be a dancer. Of course, I didn't know anything about it, and I was only 19. So it was all happening at the same time.
Was there anything about being an athlete that worked against you as a dancer? Just in terms of like which muscles were developed and that stuff?
Yeah. First of all, athletes don't take much time to warm up. You just want to get out there and do it. So in the early days, I had to learn how to be kind to my body, to take the time to breathe through muscles. And I think more sophisticated athletes, they know that now. But at that time, I don't think at the high school, college level, we knew that. Yeah, and maybe the attitude too of winning, you know, the purpose of this is to win, and also something about athletics, learning how to really be a team player. I mean, there's talk about being a team player in athletics, but it wasn't this type of sports that I played. I was a runner, which is me against a field of other people. So when I came into dance, I had to learn in a way how to make room for other people, read their signals, and understand how to read my own better.
My guest is dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Talking about athletics versus dance, and you said you really love sweat. Is that unusual for dancers?
Oh, I don't know if they would express it in that way. As you know, in ballet, the conceit is that one should exert oneself, but it never appears that it's exertion. And I think in modern dance, ever since the time, I think, of early Martha Graham, even earlier, there was a kind of premium placed on stress and force and the show of weight. So our generation, I think, we've embraced the athletic quality of dance, and we share that with our audience, breathing and sweating. Yes, it's not unusual anymore.
You grew up in Steuben, New York, which is upstate New York?
Steuben County, yes. You've done a lot of research on this.
And from what I know, you were about the only black family in that area?
Well, not the only black family. The reason we were there, we were migrant workers. So if you can imagine a German, Italian, fruit-growing, potato-growing community, the blacks who were there were brought there to harvest fruits and vegetables. So there were, I would say, and I'm only guessing, in maybe a community of maybe 20,000 people or so, probably a few hundred were black, if less than that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I was always the only black in K through 12 in my school.
Oh, really?
In my class. There were other blacks in the school, but K through 12, I was always the only black in my class.
So were you the official representative of your race to most people? You know, was there that burden?
Well, I guess in a way it was. I was very confused. That was one of the things I set out to rediscover in my years as an adult. What is my blackness? What is my racial identity? Because my mother and father, when they made the decision, my father, that is, that he wanted to be a black Yankee in about 1955 and to offer his kids everything that the white man had up north, in some ways he denied us the identity that one gets from living in a black community, going to black events, seeing black people and the black church and so on. So I didn't quite know. I knew I was black because my mother was quite militant about it, but I didn't know how it connected politically to the world. And that's taken some years of participation to understand that.
So you probably grew up feeling not quite part of either black or white culture.
Yes, very, very confused. You realize that when we stopped migrating and settled in this area, I made friends. I bonded with the white kids, and to this day I'm still friends with a few of them. But every year there would continue to be this wave, this influx of migrants that would come from the South. So suddenly for about maybe a month, 2 months every fall, there'd be numerous black people there everywhere, little black kids, and poor ones too. So I had to find a way to talk to them and to talk to my friends who were, of course, steeped in a lot of racist points of view. And I had to, like, sort of steer my way around that, be true to myself, and at the same time have friendships with these people that I live with year-round. It was difficult, but I think that's one reason I'm able to negotiate the art world today, because of that early training. Finding one's identity, even when you're the scenery around you shifts from moment to moment.
You know, I saw part of the contract that your company sends out to places where you'll be performing. And it's the only dance contract I've seen, to tell you the truth. So I don't know if this is typical or not. And I thought I'd ask you. It specifies that the heat in the stage area has to be 68 degrees at the coldest and 71 to 75 degrees at the warmest, with no drafts on the stage area, that there needs to be restrooms backstage that the public won't have access to.
Yes, of course.
Is it important to...
Even then, you don't always get those things.
Really? I mean, you have to, like, insist on these kinds of things. Many places that you travel to wouldn't have restrooms for you backstage or a comfortably temperate stage area.
You'd be surprised. We have been in dressing rooms wherein... You know, you're dressing, and suddenly, you know, through your dressing room walks the people who are going to be seeing you perform at any moment, and they want to stop and chat, or they want to ask you, you know, where the paper towels are, what have you. Things get stolen. In terms of heat, you know, the workers will have the back door open, and the wind will be blowing through. You're in a complete sweat from running through something. You get chilled. People get sick, cough. You know, these things do happen. It's not that we're just prima donnas, but people don't really understand what it is to work with your body as your primary instrument, and also the space that a performer must be into psychically and personally before they can give their best performance. Therefore, this privacy is necessary.
You're in the middle of developing a piece now with the World Saxophone Quartet.
Yes.
And the piece
is called The Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm. Anything you could tell us about the piece?
Well, the piece is really an attempt to... come to grips with a host of issues facing our nation. And the piece is from a pretty personal point of view, as a man, a black man, a gay man, what have you. And I think I've been very, very moved lately in working with Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. We've been manipulating it in different ways, backwards and so on. But that speech to me is the quintessential expression of liberal philosophy. And the philosophy of liberation. And I ask myself the question, if it worked in the 60s and it could move a nation, how flexible, how expansive are these great words of his? Can it encompass all sorts of disenfranchised groups, be they gay, be they women, be they what have you. And part of that has to do with the question of faith, God, what does faith mean to me, my generation, those of us who have experimented with we've had so many social experiments, and now we're sort of left facing mortality and death. What do we believe? The piece expresses all those things. Also, jazz music and new dance. What do we have in common? What can we find in each other? All of these questions are being asked.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Did you always have the T in the middle of your name?
As far as I know, it stands for TASS. This is one story I heard. And Bill TASS, I was told, was a racist governor of Georgia, and there was a song called Bill TASS Will Kick a Nigger's Ass. And my father had a great sense of humor, so when I was born, he named me Bill TASS. That's a story I've heard.
Huh.
So, yes, Bill TASS Jones.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
The world premiere of Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane and Company's Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Promised Land, is next week at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. It's choreographed by Bill T. Jones, with music by composer and alto saxophonist Julius Hempel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And this is Julius Hempel with the World Saxophone Quartet.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. for listening to music from Furthermore, a new recording by tenor saxophonist Ralph Moore. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's among this year's best mainstream jazz records. Kevin has a review. Deirdre Murray plays cello with some of today's most adventurous jazz composers, like Henry Threadgill, Mulhall Richard Abrams, and David Murray. Coming up, Deirdre Murray deals with stereotypes of cellos and women in jazz. And TV critic David Bianculli looks an example of a new hybrid. It's long enough to be a program, it looks like a program, but it's really a commercial. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet diplomat Yevgeny Primakov has reportedly told Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein that the international community expects Iraq to unconditionally pull out of Kuwait and that the alternative is war. Meanwhile, Soviet leader Gorbachev has again called for a peaceful solution to the Persian Gulf crisis, urging Arab leaders to take the lead. Jack Thompson of the BBC has more.
For now, the prospect of such a meeting seems remote, given the bitter rhetoric that's characterized the crisis since Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on August the 2nd. But plainly, President Gorbachev can only have spoken publicly on the basis of hard information from his advisers. Among them, of course, is Mr. Primakov, who flew to Saudi Arabia after what appeared to be abortive talks in Baghdad. In marked contrast to Mr. Gorbachev, the Soviet envoy's mood was distinctly gloomy after meeting Saddam Hussein. He said he was very disappointed and there were no plans for any more meetings with the Iraqi leader. That in itself was an about turn from Mr. Primakov's position after discussions with Saddam earlier in the month. Then he talked of possible concessions from Baghdad, as long as the United States and others promised not to attack Iraq.
Jack Thompson of the BBC. Secretary of State James Baker has warned that Iraq would suffer the most severe consequences if it uses chemical or biological weapons. In remarks before the Los Angeles World Affairs Council, Baker said that U.S. military forces have been sent to the Persian Gulf area to provide an effective military response if the situation demands it. In New York City, the U.N. Security Council has passed another resolution designed to step up the pressure on Iraq. Linda Fasulo reports from the U.N.
By a vote of 13-0, with Cuba and Yemen abstaining, the Security Council solidly approved a measure condemning Iraq's destruction of Kuwait and clearly affirming Baghdad's liability for compensating economic losses. While the measure avoids any mention of war crimes, it does condemn Saddam Hussein for the taking of hostages and ill-treatment of diplomats, as well as the deportation of Kuwaiti citizens. It orders the supply of embassies with food, water, and basic services. The resolution warns Iraq that if it does not withdraw from Kuwait, the Security Council will need to take further action. Measures under discussion include the use of military force against Iraq and the branding of Saddam Hussein as a war criminal. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Former U.S. Attorney General William French Smith has died in California, a victim of cancer. He was 73 years old. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 6 points to close at 2,430.20 on volume of some 134 million shares. Declining issues led advances by more than 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that these days a lot of young jazz musicians attend music schools which value proficiency over style. Tenor saxophonist Ralph Moore did that. If those young musicians are lucky, they get their first recording contract before they turn 20. By that standard, 33-year-old Ralph Moore was a late bloomer. But Kevin says Moore's career shows getting a slow start can be an asset.
Ralph Moore came up in jazz the old-fashioned way, through years of apprenticeship with veteran band leaders. Starting in 1981, he worked for 4 years with pianist Horace Silver and has also done stretches with drummer Roy Haynes, trumpeter Freddie Hubbard, and trombonist J.J. Johnson. Moore didn't record his first album as a leader until he was almost 29, practically old age in jazz nowadays. But because he worked for strong leaders for so long, Moore knows how to be one himself. His new album, Furthermore, on the Landmark label, is easily one of the year's best mainstream jazz records. One reason Ralph Moore's album is so good is that he coaxes strong performances from his sidemen. They include two of the young Turks of bebop, pianist Benny Green and trumpeter Roy Hargrove. Here's part of Hargrove's solo on Moore's tune, Hopscotch. That solo shows one thing that makes Roy Hargrove a trumpeter to watch. Unlike Wynton Marsalis and his many followers, Hargrove is attracted to the hot sound of Clifford Brown rather than Miles Davis's cool approach. This album also bears out something I've noticed hearing Moore and Hargrove live. The trumpeter plays better with Moore than he does in his own bands. This album is a better vehicle for Hargrove or Benny Green than their own recent albums are. Still, my favorite soloist here is Ralph Moore himself, not least because of his rich and brawny tone. By the way, the bassist and drummer there are Peter Washington and Kenny Washington, who aren't related. On most of the album, the drummer is Victor Lewis, the band's senior citizen. He was almost 40 when it was recorded. Ralph Moore, like other players who went through college jazz programs, isn't a totally individual player. On blues tunes especially, you can hear how much he's listened to John Coltrane's 1950s recordings. But you never get the feeling Moore is just skimming the surface of the style. He gets down in the dirt. Here's Ralph Moore on his 310 Blues. Ralph Moore has such a strong affinity for the blues. He even plays Neil Hefti's ballad Girl Talk as if it were a blues. Here's the tail end of the melody in the first part of his solo. Ralph Moore transcends his sources by putting so much feeling into his solos. He makes everything he plays sound like his own, whether it's borrowed or it's blue.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Ralph Moore's new album, Furthermore, is on Landmark Records. This is Fresh Air. Deirdre Murray is one of the very few cellists in jazz, and she plays with some of today's most adventurous jazz composers, like Henry Threadgill, David Murray, and Mujal Richard Abrams. She also composes, produces, and leads several ensembles with bassist Fred Hopkins. Murray plays on Mujal Richard Abrams' new album, Haringa Suite.
Part is segments of other people's music, and what I'm actually doing is a chorusing what other musicians are doing, so that it takes what they do takes on a different quality. It's very interesting what he did. There, a lot of the music didn't have like a contrapunt line or a different line. It was just something that, you know, saxophonist did, or this person did, or that person did, and I doing it in unison with them. But when you put the two together, it sounds a different way.
Mm-hmm. Abrams also wrote a cadenza for you, or you're improvising it, I'm not sure which.
Improvised.
Okay. So that's totally improvised,
sure.
The cadenza?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what you did with it?
I really can't, because I haven't heard it. That's about a year ago. I've seen a few people in the street, and they say, that's a really... I've been hanging out with Fred Hopkins, and they say, Fred, that's a really great bass solo you played. And I said, is there a bass solo? And he said, Deirdre, that's what you did. So that's all I can answer. What I was trying to do was something very different than what the other people did. What I do musically is based on sound rather than running patterns, although, of course, I run patterns. And what I was trying to do is get as far away from what anybody else did as I could, and I think the nature of the instrument would allow me to do that.
Think there are so few cellists in jazz? Is it something inherently involved with the instrument? Is the instrument particularly hard to play in a jazz setting, or is that another reason?
I just think that basically, that's a very big question. I think it's class issues. I think that in general, the more middle class you are, the more you tend to have start playing those instruments, you know, especially for black people earlier. If you're in, you know, talented in music, and you're a kid, and you know you're a black kid, what's likely to happen is you're going to play piano, or maybe even clarinet in a marching band, or something else. You're not likely to play something where you're going to play in a string quartet, because it might socially not come up.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get to play cello?
I wanted to be a violinist, and I was watching those. I can't remember the movie, but it's an old Betty Davis movie, and my mother used to work in the post office at night, and I said, Ma, I have to do this thing. I got to play this violin. And my mother was a dancer, so what she said to me was, you can play something that looks like that, but nothing squeaking high. So instead of me playing the violin, she says, cello, that's nice and low. That won't keep me awake in the daytime while she was sleeping. So when I, you know, it's a public, New York public school system, I was probably 10, and instead of asking for a violin, which is what I really wanted, they gave me a cello.
And you took to it right away?
Yeah, immediately.
You played in a couple of symphonies, right?
Yeah, a long time ago.
How long? How old were you?
19, 20, someplace in there.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard as a black cellist to get a chair in the symphonies?
No, what really, my problem in the symphony was that it wasn't my kind of a groove. I mean, I hated wearing black dresses.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was that basic. I was always nervous. It wasn't the music. It was the, I was always used to being free spirit, and I could not stand to be restrained. I could not stand bear to play a melody the same way twice. So, therefore, I never fit. And also, I used to have great stage fright. Anything that, you know, I could play everything at home, and as soon as I got in front of people in terms of classical music, I would totally freeze up. I mean, great. It was like almost phobic. I had a great phobia. But that was because it was against my nature to repeat anything.
So when you started playing jazz, did the phobia go away?
Well, yes, I never repeat. I mean, that's the idea. It's the reason I love jazz beyond, you know, obvious reasons that it's totally expressive to the individual self. I mean, you never have to do anything the same way twice. Although, if I want to, I can.
When you started playing jazz, was it hard to get bands that would accept you because you were a cellist and not a bassist?
No, because I always had my own band.
Oh, always. That's one way of getting around it.
Well, yeah, well, I didn't know what I was doing was weird until I was like 22 or 23 years old. I really didn't know because I was always insulated. You know, I played with my cousin, I had a girl cousin, we had our own bands, and we made records, and we ran around the country. I didn't know, you know, it's you know, you're talking about the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know that what I was doing was unique until I was about 23, 24. And then by the time I was 30, I found out that was really unique.
Did being a woman ever stand in your way at all?
I think that it stood most in my way because the lifestyle, especially even now, but 10, 15 years ago, is not... what's the word, amenable to the way I was raised. Basically, you know, I'm very, what's the word, studious. And basically all I do is play the music and then I leave. So therefore hanging out, carousing and all that stuff was never my bag. So I think that the way I was raised didn't go with how it is. So, and also that's why I'm saying that by the time I became 30, I realized what I was doing was uniquely weird because then it was, how many bands, you know, by the time you're 30, if you've been playing long enough, people have to take you seriously, but then they don't want to because there is really no serious cello tradition in jazz and that men were having, you know, serious problems with it.
How do those problems get expressed to you?
You can't play. Something that basic. I know you can't play the blues. What are you doing here? Or I'll be in a band, everybody in the band gets reviewed except for me. Or you get a review, people say that, oh, she must be somebody's girlfriend. Or they, if you are running a band or you're running a session, I was running a session as a producer for somebody's record that I won't talk about. And when all the musicians, I had hired all the musicians, but they thought I was a secretary. And when all the musicians came in, they kept looking for the producer and they shook everybody's hand. And they kept looking. I watched them look. I said, well, here I am, guys. You know, so that's how it's expressed.
Since there is no cello tradition in jazz, when you started playing jazz a lot, did you miss having anyone to base your sound on or to base your part on?
Well, I based my sound off of basically bassists and saxophonists like Eric Dolphy.
Mm-hmm.
And because there is no cello tradition, nobody told me that was weird either. You have to realize, in other words, whatever came in my mind, my imagination to do, I just did it. Because no one could tell me it was wrong to do because I didn't have a teacher. I had a cello teacher, but I didn't have a teacher in jazz. So I learned just from experience. If I heard something that Eric Dolphy did, I would take it and try to do it. It would come out differently on cello, but the concept, the ideology from which it sprung is what I would do.
On Henry Threadgill's records, you play cello and Fred Hopkins plays bass.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Fred Hopkins have been working together in your own band now. So I guess you've really been liking working together and the sound that you get together?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you been learning a lot about the differences between cello and bass by playing together?
No, because
I already know it, right?
I always knew. It's the thing I like about Fred is that he is so confident that as a bass player, he doesn't feel that I'm trying to take away his function. Not most, but a lot of bass players used to feel that I was, you know, stepping on their toes, but actually I was fulfilling this other function. But Fred, you know, has no problem with that. We'll do let's say a phrase, and he'll play the first half, and I'll play the second half, you know, naturally, without any music, because we actually hear it that way.
So do some people still think that a cello can't swing, so to speak?
Sure. I think a lot of people still think that. Yeah. They might think that I can swing, but cello cannot.
And you want to prove otherwise?
Yeah, I just want to put that to rest forever. Amen. And I want to do something that's recorded that puts that to rest, so no one ever talks about that ever again.
Well, Deirdre Murray, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Cellist Deirdre Murray. Here's Murray playing a walking cello line with Fred Hopkins on bass from Henry Threadgill's latest album, Rag, Bush, and All. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news today from the United Nations and the Security Council's action on the invasion of Kuwait. Also, a report from Jackie Lydon on her interviews with some of the Western hostages who are being held in Baghdad. She saw them last week. And we'll also have a talk about the Book of Jay. That's a translation of part of the Hebrew Bible. We'll be talking with the poet David Rosenberg, who did it together with scholar Harold Bloom, and what biblical scholar Richard Elliott Friedman thinks about this new and unusual translation, which comes to the conclusion that someone who wrote much of the Old Testament was probably a woman.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new kind of TV program turning up without warning on different networks, but always with the same stars and messages. TV critic David Bianculli has tracked one of these shows down.
One time I saw it late at night on Nickelodeon. Another time I saw it early in the morning on TNT. Other times, usually just after midnight, I saw it on cable superstations TBS and WWOR. Maybe you've seen it too. It's the latest talk show to make the rounds, and it features Bruce Weitz, who used to play Mick Belker on Hill Street Blues. But he's not the guest, he's the host. His guest trains dogs for a living. And the conversation goes something like this.
David's revolutionary approach to obedience training can ensure the safety and well-being of your dog. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to meet my friend, Mr. David Dykeman.
How you doing?
How are you? I'm good. Listen, I got a couple of questions.
Very
dramatic
for you.
National television commercial that highlights some of the things you're talking about.
The commercial that we're going to release is it's a dramatization from the place of an owner that has very little understanding of their animal's personality and its needs. a lot of As a matter of fact, we have a clip of this commercial that we've been talking about. We'd like you to take a look at it, and then we'll come right back and continue our discussion with David Beckman.
The easy-to-use Command Performance System includes the complete video training course from day one to off-leash, easy-to-follow field training cards for each lesson, and the Command Performance Training Progress Chart. There's never been a dog training system like this. Command Performance. Unleash the potential in your dog. Here's how to order.
The success of entire cable networks devoted to home shopping have convinced some sponsors that programs, ones with stories instead of sales pitches, are an unnecessary evil. Now they make full-length commercials that look like talk shows or cooking shows, and they hire unknown or well-known actors to serve as hosts, and they spend the entire 30 or 60 minutes selling their chintzy stuff. According to the TV industry and the TV guide listings, these shows are called commercial programs. It used to be that commercial programs were weekly TV series with ads, as opposed to non-commercial programs without ads, like Masterpiece Theater. But in the last few years, instead of sponsoring programs so that people will see their ads, advertisers have begun eliminating the middleman. Maybe they hired Bruce Weitz to host this dog training commercial program because his character on Hill Street growled a lot and was known as Belker the Biter. But why did Weitz agree to do it? And why should anyone be dumb enough or bored enough to watch it? And if TV is going to show more and more of these mega commercials, why don't they at least break up the monotony and make the cycle complete by interrupting them with occasional 30-second dramas and sitcoms? I'll be happy to provide the answers to all these questions, along with an easy way to identify and avoid all sneaky commercials disguising themselves as actual programming. Just send a self-addressed stamped envelope and $29.95 to Fresh Air. And if you act now, I'll throw in one of my leftover Bianculli bamboo steamers.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Audrey Voblaitis, and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with rock critic Robert Christgau about his new consumer guide to over 3,000 records of the past decade. And we meet Sam Arkoff, co-founder of American International Pictures, which gave us such teen classics as I Was a Teenage Werewolf. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.